it's nice not to just be the place where people come to get something, but where they learn something at the same time, and that you hope to share with them.
Welcome to the Acoustic Guitar Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Grizzle, joined today by co-host Elton Bradman. For this episode, we're taking you on a virtual road trip across the United States to visit four independent guitar stores. We'll catch up with Griffin Stringed Instruments in Palo Alto, California, Elderly Instruments in Lansing, Michigan, Acoustic Music Works in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Groon Guitars in Nashville, Tennessee. As you'll hear, each of these shops is more than just a retail outlet. Local music stores are vital to the communities they serve, and their staff often have knowledge and experience you won't find anywhere else. Be sure to take note at the end of the episode, for example, when George Groon shares five crucial things to listen for when looking for your next guitar. With the darkest days of the pandemic in the rearview mirror, knock on wood, these businesses are hanging tough, getting creative, and looking forward to the future. A little housekeeping before we hit the road. If you're enjoying this podcast, please become a patron by going to patreon.com/acousticguitarplus. You'll get some great perks when you sign up, including access to part two of this episode. We'd also love for you to leave a five-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. This helps other guitarists find the show, which helps us too. We really appreciate it. And last but not least, we're releasing this episode during peak holiday shopping season for a reason. We want to encourage you to visit your local guitar store for all your gifting needs, or just to treat yourself. You'll find more information about each of the shops featured in this episode in our show notes. For this episode, we start off with Richard Johnson. Richard's the co-founder of Griffin Stringed Instruments, which has been serving musicians at its location on the corner of Lambert Avenue and Park Boulevard in Palo Alto, California, since 1975.
I mean, some people come to hang out, and they're welcome to do that. The repair department brings in a lot of people. The pandemic has meant that many people are discovering or rediscovering the instruments that they hadn't used recently. And in rediscovering them, they're discovering that they don't work as well as they had hoped they would. So that was the first thing that happened to us when we opened again after being shut for several weeks during the height of the beginning stages of the pandemic, was that the repair demand was just off the charts. And of course, at that point, we didn't have as many repair people as we had had previously. The cost of living had kind of gutted the repair department. We lost three really good repair people in less than 2 years to Portland. So we were, you know, we've been struggling ever since, and we've had to go to appointments and trying to have a more organized flow of repair work, because otherwise we would just be, you know, we'd be so inundated with cases that there was no place to walk. The days of being able to just throw your guitar in the trunk and drive to Griffin and have somebody adjust your truss rod and lower your action, and while you're off getting lunch, and then be back on the road to your gig that night, I'm afraid those days are over. Let's face it, we're musicians planning ahead, you know.
I'm so curious, you know, because you have survived the downturn in the mid 80s when things were, you know, the economy was crazy, plus people were going to synths and away from acoustic music.
Right.
You survived these dips. Is there some part of you that feels like, yeah, we'll get through this too. Like, this is just another speed bump.
Yes, it is. And we certainly have that. We certainly have that feeling. We feel we have a good core of staff. We did survive the acoustic drought of the 80s because repair work meant that we were so busy that when we bought an instrument, we didn't have time to fix it. So we had a stash of older Martins and Gibsons and a lot of instruments. We didn't work on electrics in those days in the attic. And so when things got grim, we were able to take something, you know, down and fix it up and sell it. But it was something that we had purchased sometimes several years earlier. And it wasn't until we'd done an inventory one year and our accountant came to us and said, "I'm going to fudge your tax returns." And we said, "Whoa, what do you mean? Isn't that kind of risky?" And he says, "I'm going to report that you made more than you actually did." And we said, "Well, why would you do that?" And he says, "Well, because anyone looking at your tax return, if I file it accurately, is going to assume that you're dealing drugs or you're doing something else, because nobody in his right mind would run a business that's eating itself." Mm-hmm. So we said, "Okay." But he was right. I mean, we were burning through our reserves without realizing it. And of course, the prices of those instruments had gone up.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think a lot of guitarists would call that investing.
Yes. Right.
So where do you feel we are now? I mean, you know, yeah, there's this pandemic thing, but in general, do you feel like, you know, there's a new generation who's hungry, taking over, influenced, listening and buying?
There definitely is. And I think it's because a lot of people who had to isolate and basically sequester and avoid going out, once you've done that for several months and you've learned things to do that are satisfying, you don't exactly just flip a switch and throw your guitar in its case and stuff it back, you know, behind the winter coats in the closet. Playing music, being able to, you know, entertain yourself and enjoying that creative surge becomes kind of a part of who you are. And it seems like it's continuing. We haven't seen a drop in demand. Now with the current economic stuff, I don't know, you know, but so far it doesn't seem like people are looking at their 401k stock portfolio's performance and saying, "Okay, no more guitars." Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened yet. And of course, I'm hoping it doesn't. People don't come in and say, "Man, my retirement account sucks. I'm going to buy guitars." You know, they just buy a guitar.
Right.
But one thing is that I think a lot of people have realized that compared to the ways they were spending money before the pandemic, musical instruments are still relatively cheap, even if they're a couple of thousand bucks or more. If you have time for my favorite Silicon Valley guitar collector story, customer came in. He's been a customer for many years. He's come to house concerts and took lessons for a while. He's primarily a fingerstyle player. Pretty active, and has bought instruments, not a tremendous number, but he brought in four or five that he wanted to leave on consignment, and three of them we took in. And as we were writing him up, I said, "Gee, you know, I hope you're still playing." And he says, "Oh yeah, I'm playing more than ever, but this is the year I'm going to get down to less than 100 guitars." And the guy, the staff guy next to me, you know, did the kind of thing, and the guy wheeled. I mean, he was ready. He said, "Listen, I don't chase women half my age. I don't buy Ferraris. I don't get expensive divorces. My family knows where I am. I'm in the garage playing guitars, and they think it's great. Okay?" And he said, okay.
Next, we head to Lansing, Michigan. Elderly Instruments was founded by Stan Verben in 1972. It's their 50th anniversary this year. We catch up with Stan and his daughter, heir apparent Lillian Verben, about the role elderly plays in the community.
What I'm kind of continuing is being supportive. I think a lot of musicians, especially beginner and local musicians, they need a music store that actually cares about their craft and wants them to do well and to have the right instrument. And so I think you've always been a good support for the larger music community, but I'm certainly focused on that moving forward.
And we've also, I think, to blow our own horn, I'd say we've helped start a lot of local things. For instance, the ukulele group that has turned into a pretty big thing around here. Originally started in the basement of our store, basically, in our events room, as we call it, a small room in the basement.
And now it's a 3-day festival in our little neighborhoods.
Right. And so anyway, we've encouraged people to do things like that and been involved in it very often as well.
Y'all have been around long enough probably to see a couple generations of musicians buying things from your stores at this point, right?
In general, we have 5 generations within our staff. Dang. And so we have not only seen a lot of music, but played a lot of music. It's multi-generational, our being.
And we try to appreciate the music that everybody likes here. It isn't always possible, but it's pretty close.
If you can play it on a fretted instrument, we're into it.
And what have you been noticing people are most into these days?
There was this new interest from people my age in the vintage market. And I didn't, at least around here, I didn't have friends who were like really into the history behind all the instruments. Everybody likes a timeless model, but people were looking into who made it during this period and what were the changes and how is it affecting building now. And I thought that was a difference, at least for me. And I think that's kind of the sweet spot we're at right now, is that this new wave of musicians, at least new wave to a lot of people, they're really educated and like self-educated about just like the history of the music, who played it, how did this instrument come to be in my hands?
You know, when it really comes down to it, although we may have our greatest strength in folk, bluegrass, old time music, just acoustic music in general, you know, all these things interact somehow or other. And I like to think that, and especially in the days when we carried records, LPs and CDs, which are now almost all gone, and we have some now, but in those days, it was really interesting because we'd have people come to us who are particularly interested in,
this thing.
but at the same time, they look in the next bin and they say, well, what's this? This is interesting. And we might be playing it on a sound system in the record room or what we call the record room then, and the CDs room at some point. We might be playing it on the sound system and they'd say, what's that? I want to get that. I've never heard anything like that, but it speaks to me, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's always been, I kind of miss that because it's a little harder to have that kind of interaction with people, because now we mostly talk with them about instruments and such, and that's okay. It's certainly our greatest strength, but it's really nice to see how, you know, people, it's nice to be a source of, it's nice not to just be the place where people come to get something, but where they learn something at the same time and that you hope to share with them. Mm-hmm.
You have a website and you used to have a catalog, so not all your customers shop in person, but why do you think a brick and mortar location is important for selling guitars?
You can put it in your hands.
That's the obvious thing. So really get it in your hands and see how it feels and looks to you.
And I mean,
how it speaks to you.
Yeah. But granted, we've always tried to keep our online as informative as like the in-person experience. So like what you can call and get a bunch of instruments demoed for you. We'll send you the MP3s. You can hear it, but it's just not the same.
Well, it's not, but you know, but the other thing is we opened a store in 1972 and we sent out our first mail order catalog in 1975. Yep. And so we've been dealing with it for a long, long time now. Mm-hmm. And that,
helps.
You know, so we've always understood, I mean, always, but we learned quickly the differences that people need it, you know, in terms of how to nav- you know, when you live in California and we're out in Michigan, well, you're not going to just drive over here. People, you know, people have always said to me, well, how do people do that? Why, you know, why would anybody buy a guitar or a banjo or a mandolin or anything like that via the mail? I mean, you gotta feel it, touch it, hold it, all the things we said before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the answer is that people do it all the time.
Yeah.
And why, I guess, you know, what we've always worked on to help make it happen is that people trust us. I mean, we make a big deal out of that, but people do very often trust us. They say, well, you know, what happens if I don't like it? Well, you can send it back. So what we try to do is give people more information. We say, look, before you order it from us, and we want you to really talk to somebody who's got it in their hands, let them look it all over, you know, put it in their hands and say, okay, it's got a tiny scratch here. If that tiny scratch is going to bother you, don't buy it, you know. I mean, sometimes I hear people saying things that you think they're trying to talk people out of buying things, but they're not. They're just trying to give them the information that they really want to have. You know, people come in and you talk to them. I've always enjoyed talking with customers, and our salespeople do also. And we try to remind them, don't forget, if you're talking to somebody who, you know, sounds like they know what they're talking about,
they do.
Find out something from them, because they probably know something that we don't or that you don't. And it's really, I think it's an important interaction, because ultimately the customers decide what they want to buy. I mean, it's just a basic, you know, just besides it, gathering information for ourselves, it's a good sales thing, because if you learn what people want, then you can have it for them the next time they come in.
So how are you celebrating the store's 50th birthday?
Lily's taken over the reins of the store. We're heading towards the 100th now. And, you know, I'm going to be, I'll be, for the 100th, I'll be 125.
A true fixture, yeah, right?
That's right. So if I can make it for the 100th, I'll be really decrepit. It's what it'll be.
We love vintage at Elderly.
Oh, yeah. That's it's right. Not called that's Elderly right. For nothing, right?
That's right.
My whole life is Elderly. Like, people ask about my childhood, and I'm like, yeah, I was at gigs, I was at jams. So, like, all the people and, you know, the music is what sparked my interest. But, like, not to be sappy, but I think the first time Dad and I talked about what Elderly would look like if the two of us were the, you know, at the helm, rather than me asking him all sorts of stuff he didn't want to bother with me about.
Oh, I didn't.
but you know, like, that was, I grew up at Elderly, you know, and I have had my own homecoming in coming home and working at the store. And so I don't have many bad days. I'm a happy camper most days.
Continuing east, we visit Raymond Morin, luthier and shop manager at Acoustic Music Works in Pittsburgh. Acoustic Music Works has been serving Western Pennsylvania for close to 20 years.
We're busier than we've ever been. We're really at the cusp of what two people can do. You know, Steve would say we're two people doing the job of five people, and that's probably an understatement. From a volume perspective, we're bigger than we've ever been. If for some reason the tap was turned off right now, I'd have a ton of work to catch up on. It's one of these things where you just feel happy. Well, having more work is better than not having enough. And yeah, we've just dug in so deep with Eastman, our key boutique-y brands like Collings and Huss and Dalton, Kevin Kopp, Beard. These guys know that we'll take anything that they can give us. You know, it's just the world's so different now to where it used to be. We could pick up some orphans from some of these companies once in a while. And now it's just like, nope, everybody's just waiting to get their stuff. And yeah, I'd say other than having a very small team, we're at, you know, in as good shape we've ever been. Everybody's healthy here and likes being busy, you know.
What about on the community side of things? I understand you organize concerts for Acoustic Music Works.
So we're like a house show size when we're doing something in the store. There's a couple of tiers to it. Steve, the store owner, was on the board of the local folk music society for decades. He was even the president for some amount of time. So the store's always been a sponsor of roots music, bluegrass music, folk music in general. And those were kind of Steve's particular genres that he was really into. Then when I came on, I brought this perspective of fingerstyle, English and British Isles music, ragtime, and underground acoustic music, you know, like American primitive guitar, you know, not that we're calling it that anymore, but, you know, guitar soli, I'd say, and underground singer-songwriter, indie folk, stuff like that. That became kind of my domain. So the store has done a couple of kind of big gestures towards underground stuff. Like we sponsored this festival called Thousand Incarnations of the Rose a few years ago that brought together all of these guitar soli players in Tacoma Park, you know, to kind of celebrate the legacy of John Fahey and stuff like that. Yeah, the show stuff is always fantastic. You know, it's, you get to see like super high level players in a really intimate setting. And, you know, some of my favorite guitar players in the world have played here, you know, guys like Nathan Salzberg and some really just kind of crazy modern players like Ian Ethan Case and Anton DeFore, and just people that you're just like, wow, this is this little place, you know, and there's an energy here and people want to contribute to it.
What are some important lessons you've learned or memorable experiences you've had during your time working at the shop?
As far as guitars, like I've learned so much from Collings Guitars, just about how to make what a great guitar is and what like a lifetime guitar is. But when I first started, we were still speccing Brazilian Rosewood Collings, and I got to meet Bill Collings on a trip to Austin. I got to play the Waterloo prototypes before they were released. It was nerve-wracking, but it was also super, super fun because I'm sitting on a couch with Bill Collings for, you know, the Collings couch in their lobby. I'm sitting on it with him for like a half hour. And he's like passing me the X-brace, passing me the ladder brace. What do you like better? What do you like better? And I'm like, they're both awesome. You know, he wanted to hear like country blues and stuff like that. He's like, play Candyman. Became good friends with Ernie Hawkins through working at this shop. We filmed something here for him for acoustic guitar on a Reverend Gary Davis lesson. And he comes in, does demos once in a while. That's been fantastic. He and I work together all the time now. And Steve, the store owner, you know, that's been the absolute best thing because he's just been so encouraging and game for, you know, just he's very happy with how everything is. And like, he's all for stretching out. He's all for giving back. It's just one of those things you just feel lucky to be part of it.
Our last stop is in Nashville, Tennessee, where George Gruen of Gruen Guitars shares his expertise and fills us in on the economics of buying and selling guitars, both vintage and new.
Well, you know, snakes and guitars have one thing in common, and that is that in my mind, they fit in a Linnaean taxonomic order. So my background, I collected snakes since I was 8 years old. I didn't get a guitar until I started college, but I had friends who played earlier. And I found by looking at their instruments and listening to them talk about it, that it was just like looking at snakes, and that they fit in the Linnaean taxonomic order perfectly. My father was a pathologist. I saw my first autopsy before I was 10. And autopsy technique and looking at guitars to figure out what happened to them, forensic exams are the exact same methodology. And I still today look at guitars the way a zoological taxonomist would to figure out what is it, and the way a forensic pathologist would look at it to figure out what is the life cycle that this particular instrument has been through. I'll listen to what the owner or the seller is trying to tell me. But like Ronnie said, trust but verify. And I don't think of much else that Ronnie ever said that I'd agree with, but I agree with that statement. And a lot of times people don't know what they have, or if they do know, they don't choose to tell me all the things that they know might be wrong with it. And sometimes you wouldn't believe it, they actually lie.
In our conversations with other stores, we've been hearing about an increase in demand. What do you think is causing that increase in the guitar market?
What's really supporting the market now is millennials born starting 1980. And interestingly enough, the children of the millennials are not like the children of the boomers. The children of the millennials seem to like some of the same music that their daddy does. And they're buying guitars in quantity. And companies like Martin, Fender, Taylor, Gibson, they're doing record volumes. They've never sold as many as they are right now. And there's another factor, and that is for most of my career, women as buyers were a very tiny segment of the market. And now it depends on the type of music that they're playing, but it can be 15, 20% of buyers, depending on some types of music. And classical guitar can be 50%, close to it. When you have a combination now of several, three generations at least, older boomers are out, but younger boomers are still in. Younger boomers, millennials, children of millennials, that's three generational groups, plus adding in a large contingent of women who used to be a very small segment of the market and now are quite a significant segment, that can make for a very healthy market. And then you can add in some economic and other factors, because, you know, in the real world, it's a very rare event that one factor changing can account for it. You know, in scientific experiments, we like to design an experiment where you change one variable at a time and see what happens. But in the real world, it's never that simple. So it means that you really have a tough time sometimes telling why things happened. But I know from talking to my customers every day that the demographics of the market are shifting. It's not just the economy that drives it. And very little of the buying that I see happening is because of pent-up demand from COVID. It's not that they were cooped up in their house and they didn't have anything better to do than play their guitar. In fact, a lot of the professional players say that it's been rather discouraging during COVID and they've gotten out of practice. So anyway, I've babbled at considerable length. Let me see if you guys have any questions.
We're interested in the makeup of sales in your shop. Are you selling more vintage or new guitars these days?
We now, today, sell more new Martins than used Martins. The availability of the used ones is not the same. It's a finite number of them out there. There's a lot of people wanting them, and it's harder for a dealer like me to land them. People try every which way to go around dealers. They may put it on Reverb or eBay or whatever, but often enough, they're asking higher than ever, sometimes unrealistically high. But the market still is new, used, and what I would sometimes call vintage, except the term vintage is becoming almost meaningless. It's better now to substitute the name collectible. Or golden era. But for each maker, the golden era may be different. And even people come in, they say, oh, I have to get a guitar that sounds like James Taylor. I mean, it's so good. And I say, well, have you ever heard his guitar? And people say, well, what kind of stupid question is that? I've been to every concert he's ever done within 300 miles of where I live. And I have every recording that's available anywhere from him. Of course, I know what his guitar sounds like. It's a stupid, dumb question. No. Have you ever heard sound waves that were produced by the vibrating soundboard of his guitar that went through the air to your tympanic membrane, which stimulated the little bones in your middle ear, which stimulated the cilia in the cochlea of the ear, which then went to your brain, which processed it? Have you ever heard his guitar? No, you heard a note that he plunked on the guitar 20 years ago that went into a microphone, went into a mixing board where they twiddled it around, and then it went on tape, and then they did it later onto digital or onto vinyl, and then you take it, and it depends on the quality of your turntable and the quality of your amplifier and the quality of your speakers, and you haven't ever heard his guitar. Unless you sat in the room with him, close to him, with nothing but air connecting the sound of his guitar to your ear. How many of those have you heard? And the fact is that some instruments record real differently, or some microphones, their frequency response is not the same as your ear. By the time you get done with all that processing, you don't hear the same dynamic range and you don't hear all the same tonalities, but you particularly don't hear the same dynamic range. Because if you're recording where that microphone is shoved that far from the instrument, you can't overdrive, or you can overdrive, you can't do those chops. You can't do chop power chords like you would do chopping on an F5 mandolin or some of what you do on an acoustic guitar. And if you play with a pickup on the guitar, then you sure enough, you know, even if the pickup does a great job of picking up the sound, do you listen to guitars by putting your ear direct on the instrument and playing it? Try it sometime. You can do it well with an acoustic guitar. And you know what it sounds like if you hold it, or you can play with your ear physically in contact with the body and do that. It sounds like a good pickup, which is not the same as a sound through air. And then if you, you know, by the time you process signals and all that, it's, you could go on and on and on discussing it, but the real sound of an acoustic that I listen for is truly acoustic. But what a lot of session players would come and want is they'd listen to things, they were listening for what they thought would record well, and then they'd insist they have to borrow it for the night and go to the studio and play it back and listen how it records. And I used to think, how stupid is that? They can't, isn't their ear good enough? And then now I realize that it wasn't so stupid, because some things that record really well don't sound that great to my ear, and some things that sound marvelous to my ear sound a bit mushy or unfocused on the recording.
What do you think people should listen for when demoing a guitar?
Now, one thing I can say that you've probably figured out is that I am somewhat opinionated. And I hope that I can back up some of those opinions, but I do think that tone is not subjective. And I'll leave you with one thing. When I'm listening, I don't consider sound to be truly, completely subjective. There's some subjective thing in it, but balance. A lot of people think of balance as nothing but volume, but there's five types of balance I listen for. I listen for balance of volume. I want string to string, equal volume to equal pressure, and up and down each string. But I want balance of sustain. If you hit a six-note chord, do they fade equally? You want not only length of sustain, but do all the notes sustain equally? I want balance of dynamic range. I want every note to be capable of being played soft, medium, and loud without distortion. And I want balance of complexity of tone. Every note has a fundamental, and above and below it, there are harmonics. Some guitars have lots of rich harmonics on the bass, but very little other than the dominant on the trebles. Some have beautiful balance throughout. I want that kind of balance. And lastly, I want balance of clarity of articulation. All notes should be crisp and clear. I don't want thumpy bass. Some types of music sound good with thumpy bass. That's what you got a palm of hand for. If the notes are inherently crisp and clear, you know how you can make them thumpy. But if they're thumpy, you can't make them crisp and clear. I want the clarity of balance. All of those five components, that's what I listen for. If they have those, there's still different tone between guitars that have Sitka versus Adirondack spruce, or maple versus mahogany versus koa versus walnut versus rosewood. But if it has those five elements that are doing well, it will be a good guitar. And with that, we'll close.
Thanks for listening. You can find part two of this episode at patreon.com/acousticguitarplus. In part two, we continue our conversation with George Groon, where he shares his expertise on the golden era of instruments from Martin, Gibson, and a whole lot more. The Acoustic Guitar Podcast is brought to you by the team at Acoustic Guitar Magazine. I'm your host, Nick Grizzle, joined for this episode by co-host Elton Bradman. Our theme song was composed by Adam Perlmutter and performed for this episode by Jeffrey Pepper Rogers. The Acoustic Guitar Podcast is directed and edited by Joey Lusterman. Tanya Gonzalez is our producer. Executive producers for the Acoustic Guitar Podcast are Lizzie Lusterman and Stephanie Campos Del Broy. If you enjoy this podcast and want to support us, visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/acousticguitarplus or find the link in our show notes for this episode. As a supporter, you'll have access to exclusive bonus episodes along with other special perks. And if you're already a patron, thank you so much for your support.